Hi, I'm Al Majoros. I am a three-year cancer survivor. My blog, The Cancer Warrior, is one of the top 10 breast cancer blogs, according to blogs.com. I'm here to bring a fresh, upbeat perspective to a topic that to some may seem scary. A positive mental attitude got me through my cancer, and I hope to share that with you.
Giving back is what Brett Wilson is all about. When he was 2 years old, he was given 6 months to live when he was diagnosed with leukemia.
That was about 38 years ago, and some have called him a walking miracle. Now he wants to help other cancer survivors through their survivorship by being a patient navigator. Let's meet this amazing man right now. How are you today, Brett?
I'm doing awesome. How are you doing, Mel?
Excellent, excellent. Thank you for coming on the show today. So I want to start, well, from the beginning. Tell me about how you were diagnosed as a child, and let's go from there.
I was born in 1972. And in 1974, I was diagnosed with ALL, and at
which is what?
Acute lymphocytic leukemia.
Oh.
So that is a bloodborne cancer, and at the time, during treatment, they gave me 6 months to live, and so they had treated me with chemotherapy and radiation. During that time, I think I lost my hair once during that one, and had 5.5 years of chemo and radiation before I went into what I called remission. They don't call that remission now. There's some other terminology that they use going from a certain time frame to a certain time frame. And anyway, I ended up getting
5.5 years?
Yeah, 5.5 years.
Wow. How did you deal with that when you were a child? I mean that was just normal for you, but...
Yeah, but see, I was so young because I was only 2 when I was diagnosed with that.
Oh, okay.
And so I really don't know the parameters of that, but I do know that after, as I grew up, that I had had some short-term memory loss during my grade school years, and also I had evidently an eye issue with a blood blockage into behind my eyes, and so I lost partial sight in my right eye.
Oh.
So I can see peripherally, but I cannot see straight on.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Wow. It's not surprising with all the radiation and chemo they pumped
into.
No,
they had, at the time, too, they had also irradiated my brain, so that kind of caused some of the learning difficulties later on in life.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, they really didn't know what they were doing, so it was just a blessing, basically, that I was able to overcome what I did.
Wow. So how long were you in, well, what you call remission or cancer-free, and then you were...
About a year and a half.
Oh, wow. So yeah. You were like...
And then I got non-Hodgkin's.
Oh, my goodness. Do they think that was from all the chemo and radiation? Well, they're not going to say, but...
I mean, research tells you now that probably that one was the byproduct of the first one, but...
Oh, my goodness.
I was diagnosed with that at age of 9, and then I had 3.5 years more with chemo and radiation until I was 12.
Good grief.
So that was a little difficult time frame there, because that's where I remember a lot of the issues with dealing with people and learning about differences and people not understanding, and a lot of things that maybe other children out there go through is, you know, establishing friendships and different things and kind of being sheltered. I really didn't have the opportunity to make a great deal of friends, either because I wasn't in school to do it or I felt so bad I didn't want to go to school because I knew I was going to be ridiculed.
Yeah, were you ridiculed a lot when you were going through treatment?
Yeah, a little bit, because it wasn't looked at that I was going for treatment. It was looked at that I was going to school, and I was not going to school, and so therefore the kids, I think there was a little jealousy there, but it wasn't because I didn't want to go, because you didn't feel like,
yeah,
you felt
like
trash, and so, you know, you didn't, that, you know, really wasn't an optional thing, and so, I did not ever get sick and throw up except for once.
Oh, good.
And so I was very fortunate with not having to have some of the after effects. Now, my stomach was a different story because it would always get upset, but, you know, I didn't have any of the side effects. However, I didn't have any of the wonderful drugs that they have now with the, you know, the nausea drugs and all that. My nausea drug was a package of wintergreen lifesavers. So.
Oh, really?
yeah, that's
wow.
It. Yeah, the pharmacist had them on point, and we would go in and get them and start the round and start in the morning and go to blood lab first, and then you'd go to the x-ray, and then if they need you in radiation, you'd go there, and then you'd go from there to the doctor's office, and you play the waiting game and that kind of thing. So that was... quite a few years that I did that.
That's 8 years of your life right there.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy.
Yeah, well, you know, and you don't know any different. I mean,
well, yeah.
It's like the average man going to work, you're going to chemo, mm-hmm. you're going to radiation, you're going to and the great thing about it was I kept a positive attitude the whole time, and I was
excellent.
They're one of those types of children that you see on a common basis where they just are still happy no matter what they're going through. So, you know, I applaud a lot of the other folks that are going through what I went through and staying positive somehow. And so that's kind of how that went. And then after I went into remission, mm-hmm. and I was dealing with my non-Hodgkin's, is where I'd lost my hair about two other times and that kind of thing. So, you know, some of the side effects started taking place. But then as I was in high school and that kind of thing, I started showing signs of short-term memory loss. And so going through high school and college and all that was really difficult, but it was something I had to learn how to overcome and do.
How did you overcome it? I mean, I can imagine that being difficult because I have chemo brain and I know what it's like to have short-term memory loss.
Yeah, well, the great thing was my family had always been supportive, and my mother always tried to say that I was normal like the other people, but you know that's not necessarily the case when people treat you differently.
Well,
I was blessed to be able to have folks that had enough income that they could find me the resources that I needed to be successful with. And that's something my mother and my family always did. Grandparents, my brother, they always helped me try to find the resources that would help me get where I needed to be so that I could be successful. So I had a lot of tutors. I had a math tutor from 7th grade, I think, all the way through college.
No, I would need a math tutor anyway, and I didn't go through chemo.
Yeah. Well, and the fortunate thing about that whole thing with my math tutor is that was my cousin, and my cousin had had breast cancer at the time. And so that was another outlet that I also had to be able to talk to somebody that had been through my experience, that could understand what I was going through and be able to relate to me on a different level than, say, other family or friends would, because I didn't have to be careful around my friend, my cousin Nancy, because of my cancer.
Right.
And I could talk honestly and openly how I felt about what the kids were doing and who was doing what and all of that kind of thing, maybe to a different level that, you know, some parents just look at it as a naivety thing. Well, people wouldn't do that. That's my child, you know. But when you're dealing with kids, you're dealing with kids.
Right.
And so, you know, that was one of those outlets that I had as a resource to me. Plus, we did a lot of testing and we found out a lot of different things with the memory loss. And then when I went to college, I had been accepted. I graduated from Marshall University with my master's in counseling.
Okay.
And while I was an undergrad, I got my undergraduate degree in counseling, too, because originally I wanted to work in psychosocial oncology and had read a lot of the things that Jimmy Holland at the time had started doing some stuff at Sloan Kettering. And I tried and tried and tried to get myself in a position that I could be mentored and be in a program with that. Well, I was part of what they call the HELP program at Marshall. And basically, it was a tutoring program for people that had disabilities. And so that's what I ended up being enrolled in, and that really helped me, too, because after I'd had some way to be able to keep myself focused, and that was the whole thing. When I was in high school, I went to a local high school where they had a free classroom system, meaning it was built on a college-level type of courses. You would go come, and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't handle that very well because there was no structure.
Right.
And so I ended up transferring to a Catholic high school where there was some structure and ended up finishing high school with a 3.0 and then went to college. In my undergraduate, I ended up on the dean's list with a 3.0. And then graduate college, I did the same thing.
Nice.
So I never accepted my disability as a disability. I tried to do whatever was possible to overcome that because I didn't want to be the person that said, oh, well, this is what I've been dealt, and so I'm going to succumb to this and kind of cower down. That's just not the way that I was, and I'd fought too hard to be able to do what I wanted to do, no matter what the odds were of people saying my success. You know, when I was diagnosed, they gave me 6 months.
Right. And that's, you know, I'm sorry. When I talk to a lot of survivors and I, you know, see stories about when people say, oh, the doctor only gave them 2 weeks, it's like, okay, well, You know, I know people like you, and I know a lot of people like you who have only given, like, you know, a timeline, and they're still here. So I always tell people, well, you know, somebody said, well, people don't have an expiration date, mm-hmm. you know, and you can't necessarily say that one doctor says, oh, I have, you know, if you believed as a 2-year-old, if you could have had that knowledge that you only had 6 months to live, you know, you could have been like, oh, it was me, and just been like, oh, well, I'm just going to go crawl in a hole. But, you know, you decided to take your life. I mean, obviously when you were older and understood it more and say, you know what, I'm going to be positive and I'm not going to believe that I only have X amount of time to live. And that's awesome.
See, and that's the other thing too, is that's also too, when I had never been a very spiritual person.
Mm-hmm.
But I had heard time and time again that I was a walking miracle. And I never understood at such a young age what people were talking about, because I was still angry. I was still upset. I had relapsed. I was really mad and angry. And I remember a situation where my uncle had taken me to a church, and he was a Methodist minister at the time. Up in Chicago, and he had introduced me, and he had mentioned again that I had been a walking miracle, and I got really upset at him because I didn't understand what he was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly knew that God had had a reason for me to be around if I had been overcome the odds. As I started to, because I'm a very curious type of person, I want to know things.
Right.
When they were sticking me and giving me bone marrows and spinal taps and doing all the crap, I wanted to watch.
Oh, yeah, no,
when
I couldn't do that.
When they were doing blood work, I was having them say, no, you don't go to that vein, you go to this vein, here's why. You know, and I was the one kind of directing everything to tell them, you know, hey, this is what you know, where you need to be or what you need to do, because I always wanted to watch because I wanted to know.
Right.
And as I started realizing, the fact of the matter was, that was the case. You know, my grandmother is a very spiritual person herself. And so that kind of had some different connotations to it, where she believed one set of values and in the spiritual realm, and my family believed the worldly things that they heard.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were two different battles going on there. When it all came out in the wash, the fact of the matter is, yeah, I honestly believe that God had me here for a purpose, because otherwise I wouldn't have gone through and learned what I've learned from the experience that I've been through.
Right. I agree with that. I do believe, you know, and a lot of cancer survivors, I think, they think the same thing. And, oh, well, what's my purpose? But sometimes we just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and
see, I had had that defined at such an early age when I was mm-hmm. in high school. I decided at that particular point I was going to work with cancer patients. And I had finally made a decision probably about that same time frame that I would never do to anyone how everybody was treating me during
of course.
My illness. And so at that particular point when I went into college, I was looking at ways to be able that I could be helpful in that kind of thing, which is why I was looking at counseling. But on the other hand, I was also trying to figure out, all right, what didn't I have and where I was treated that I could create myself? And so I'm a very creative person, and I started a center. And at the time I started that, it was called the Nancy Hunt Foundation.
Okay.
And I was doing that in honor of my cousin who died from breast cancer, and I was going to name it after her. And what I wanted to do was I wanted at the time to provide psychosocial support to cancer patients and survivorship education, so people could know about the long-term effects of what was going on.
Right.
Because I started reading this stuff, and I was like, oh, I need to be careful about this. Oh, I need to be careful about that.
Right, and it's very frightening when you see all these, you know, like you said, side effects. And I think just now people are starting to get into survivorship and what it's actually doing to mm-hmm. survivors.
Exactly. And see, the thing of it is, though, when I finished, there wasn't a continuing survivorship protocol set in place or mm-hmm. services set in place, and there really weren't any psychosocial services. You know, a lot of people, and it's amazing to me, my mother had to go search for hours in our community. Now, yeah, we're in West Virginia, and I know the stigma that's behind the people that live in West Virginia, but it's no different than anybody in the country looking for places now to go.
Right.
There aren't counselors that are available for that, or if there are, it's phone counseling and that kind of stuff. There's not anything individually set up for cancer patients and their families, unless you're in a bigger hospital. Well, we didn't have access to that. That's not something that we could pay for or had access to.
Right.
And so, you know, St. Jude's was close, but we couldn't drive to St. Jude's every day. My mother at the time was working. My dad was working. I mean, there just wasn't that possibility then. But what I was thinking about doing was at that time with the psychosocial and the survivorship, well, because I didn't have an opportunity when I graduated to do a job in that particular area, mm-hmm. I started looking at internships because nobody had heard about it. It was new. Nobody was really doing anything. Jimmy Holland was the first person that really started delving into this kind of stuff. And she started seeing that 90% of the issue with dealing with cancer is mental. And you have to be on your mental game in order to go through the next set of treatments and the next set of things. And
you got that right.
There's a lot of emotional stuff that's involved that people just aren't looking at.
Right. I agree.
You know, and that's the thing that people are really not doing the right thing that they should be doing. So
I think it's lacking. I think you're right. And, you know, even the hospital that I'm at now, you know, they have a program that's going on, but I didn't really have anything like that, and my treatment ended a year ago.
Yeah, and I got lost in the shuffle for 20 years, and nobody ever called me and told me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I ended up going to North Carolina, and I thought, okay, I'm going to go to where there's established programs and stuff, and I found out about one through the Cancer Patient Support Program at Duke University. So I went there and I did my internship there and did some things and had worked as a counselor, and the service was a free service. And inadvertently, I became a navigator then. And what I mean by that, a patient navigator is somebody that helps people understand what's happening, helps them remove barriers to getting the care that they need. And it's different than a social work role because you're not just networking within the community. You're walking these people through the experience. Well, when I originally had gone there, I introduced myself to the patients, even though it was a free program that they had set up already because they had seen the need for it, because the person that started that program, her daughter had passed away from what I had survived in the leukemia.
Oh.
And so there was a little bit of a, I don't want to say tension, but there was a commonality there, and there was a little stress involved with that whole thing.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Me as a cancer survivor and having been through it, I was sharing my experience. And I know they say as a counselor, well, you got to be careful about what you share. But to me, it was relating to them because I'd been in their shoes.
Right.
I knew what it was like to sit there all day. I knew what it was like to feel like they felt. I knew what it was like not to be able to eat. I knew it, but I had the solutions for them because I'd already been through the experience.
So they didn't want you to share that experience?
They didn't want me to share it in the way that I was sharing it. They wanted me to do it in a way that it was less intense, I guess. It's not the word intense, but they wanted me to have some reserve with it. And at the time, I didn't want to have reserve with it because here I was. It was my opportunity to be able to share with folks and try to help them get through this whole thing. And inadvertently, what ended up happening, though, was I would have doctors and nurses and physicians come and get me.
Right.
And they would say, this person wants you to be with them, they're going down to chemo. Or this person wants you to go with them, they're going down to radiation. And so we would have conversations with these folks about what was going on and how things were going. And my husband's not eating, and this is our fourth week on chemo, and he won't eat anything. Why is this happening? Because nobody was explaining the why.
Right, exactly.
They would explain that this is going to happen, but not why it's going to happen. And the thing that I found out is there was no reassurance for these folks while they were going through it. And they didn't have anybody, and most of the time, even in my situation, you had to wait till when 5 o'clock was over, you didn't bother them. It was the next morning that you would have to come in and remember all of your questions, if you could,
right,
and your feelings, if you could, to try to explain to them and share them. But then they really didn't have any idea because they were learning too,
right,
which, you know, kind of happens. And so I inadvertently was becoming a navigator and didn't really know it at the time. And so after I finished my internship, I was found out about through the pediatric unit. And they were starting a long-term survivors clinic. And, of course, I was a great person for that. Plus,
oh,
I was trying to learn from that. Plus, I had just graduated from school. I was 22. I was like, man, I finally found everything that I wanted in this job. This is great. It was more money than I'd ever expected to to get. I wasn't doing what I was doing for money. I was doing it because the service needed to be provided, and I was looking for somebody just to listen to what I had to offer.
Right.
And so I had been involved in that, but unfortunately in that situation there was already a psychiatrist that was involved with the program, and there was that tension, well, why are you taking clients away from me? And that was never the intention. And so that kind of stalemated after a year in a grant-funded position. So once I finished that, I ended up moving to Charlotte because I had family in close to that area. I had worked with the American Cancer Society. They had some really awesome programs. They had really good things going on, but they weren't personal enough.
Right.
And I couldn't really see the justification on, you know, why would I want to do this if it's not going to be 101. You're going into communities trying to establish programs, but nobody really knows what the programs do. They don't really know where the money goes. And it's not on knock on ACS in any shape or form. It's just the way that they've developed these programs was community-oriented, but not individual-oriented. And so I was like, well, I'd like to have something a little bit more personal. I mean, a pamphlet or a group is wonderful. You know, take me to look good, feel better. Take me to all the groups that you're doing. But that what I learned, too, as a counselor is group counseling for that kind of stuff, Mel, is not necessarily what everyone wants.
Oh, I tried group counseling in person. It was no. I actually had somebody ask me if I was a cancer victim, and the therapist wasn't there at the time, and I almost ripped the person's head off. I was like, I'm not a victim.
Yeah, I understand.
You know,
and so,
like,
you know, that's not for everybody.
No.
And certainly when you put people together who are newly diagnosed with people who have already gone through a short period of time, you know, there can be all of those environmental things that's part of a group that can either ruin someone's mental state to a point, that can change their scope, that can start them to start questioning, and all the different, you know, nuances that are all part of being in a group of counseling. But there are a lot of people that don't feel comfortable sharing that kind of stuff.
Right.
They don't want anybody to know, so then where do you go? So what ended up happening from that was I had inadvertently pulled myself out of the system, so to speak, and kind of got smacked around a little bit. And I was searching, and I was like, okay, God, what's the next point? Because at this particular point in my life, Mel, I knew there was nothing I could control any longer.
Well, you know.
So I ended up working. I was working retail. I wasn't doing what I really wanted to do. I was searching for what my purpose was. I knew what it was. I was trying to figure out in North Carolina what hospitals could I visit. And so I started marketing myself about 2006. And what was called at the time Wilson Cancer Consulting. And what I was trying to do was trying to be a network to work with patients and families in local hospitals through the medical system, explaining my background, explaining my story, explaining how can I help, explaining I don't want a whole lot of income for what I'm doing. Can you just listen to what I have to offer? You know, I don't care if you use me as a guinea pig, but somebody just take the information that's in my head and let me help somebody because they need it. And so I ended up getting involved in a couple of Survivor's Days. I had been mentored a little bit by Joe Gibbs, who owns Joe Gibbs Racing, and we had talked a couple of times, and they're at one point was some opportunity maybe to do some things and that kind of thing, but never anything really concretely panned out. Well, unbeknownst to me, in 8,
yes,
about the fall of 2006, I started having stomach problems, and I ended up having to have gallbladder surgery.
Oh.
Well, I didn't have any health insurance, so we know how that came out in a high price range that
yes.
Not the average man couldn't get paid on a salary that's working in retail. So I ended up, through God's blessing, honestly, having that was written off.
Very nice.
And so I was like, okay, God's really trying to tell me something here. This is crazy. This is an exorbitant amount of money. There's no way that I could have paid that. Something's going on here. So I kept pushing, and I kept pushing, and I kept pushing. And the reason at the time that I'd started consulting business is because I didn't have my license as a counselor. I was a master's level counselor. And technically, you can't practice as a counselor without a license. And I knew that. And I was like, well, I don't really want to do that. But, you know, I can't really find any other ways to look at this thing. So right. What am I going to do? Well, about 2 years later, I was out in the community, and I had been going to the gym. And I was on the treadmill, and I was running, and I got dizzy. And I'd been having some problems getting dizzy, sitting down, walking upstairs, that kind of thing, and I couldn't figure out for the life of me what was going on. And I thought, well, maybe I'm overweight, maybe I'm out of mm-hmm. shape, you know, the normal kind of things that people think about. Well, I did have a pulse.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, that was really exciting because I was still moving, and my pulse was not showing up on this machine. And so I looked at it, and I was like, this is ludicrous.
I
don't know.
It didn't have a pulse?
No. It didn't tell a heart rate. It didn't tell anything.
Oh.
You know the little thing they put
yes,
on your finger?
Yes.
You're on the treadmill? It never showed up. Nothing showed up.
Well, it could have been broken.
And she said, well, keep walking. And I kept walking. And she's like, run. And I was like, I'm running. And so nothing showed up. And I was like, ooh, this is kind of not good. And I don't know what's going on. So I ended up going to this interview. That day was probably the second scariest day that I'd ever had because I couldn't even get out of the tunnel to walk to my car without stopping 6 or 7 times without being winded.
So what did you find out that you had?
Well, that Sunday, I'd called my internal medicine physician. And I said, I need to come in on Monday. It's an emergency. And he said, okay. That night I prayed. I was like, God, if you're telling me that I have a heart condition, please just make it something that can be fixed.
Mm-hmm.
Please let's not make this a lingering thing where I've already lingered enough. I don't need any more health challenges as it is. And I went in the next morning. I drove 70 miles an hour, 15 minutes on I-85 to come to the doctor's office to find out that I had a 28 beat per minute heart rate.
Wow.
And the electrical system in my heart was shot. And the reason that I was having the issues is because the upper chamber of my heart and the lower chamber of my heart were beating two separate ways, and they weren't communicating with each other. And he looked at me, and he said, how did you get here? I said, I drove. He said, how do you feel? I said, I'm fine. He said, how long have you been having these problems, Brett? And I said, off and on for about 6 months. Now, mind you, my pain tolerance was extremely high because of what I'd been through, and I didn't think it was any big deal, Mel. I had no idea. And he looked at me and he said, if you don't get a pacemaker put in, you're not going to be going anywhere. And so he ended up getting me set up to get a pacemaker put in. I didn't have health insurance then either because I was still working in retail at the time. And the phone call came because I was in North Carolina. My parents were in West Virginia. And the phone call came to my mother. And so I was arguing with the doctor about going in the ambulance to pay $1,000 to go to the ambulance and to ride because I didn't have the money. And I was like, are you going to pay for it? And he's like, no, I'm not paying for it. And I was like, well, I'm not paying for it. He's like, you're going. So he grabbed my phone out of my hand. He called my mom. And so I ended up having a pacemaker put in. There I was, 36 years old, with a pacemaker, not knowing any of these things were happening to me or going to happen to me because no one had educated me on the long-term effects of any of this stuff.
But can they definitively say it was from the chemo, though?
Yes.
Okay.
Because of the radiation and the chemo that I'd had, because I'd had it in my chest.
I see.
See, my non-Hodgkin's was in my neck. And so when they did the chemo and the radiation, they attributed it to adriamycin,
okay.
Which happens to be one of those drugs that was the only drug that I ever got sick on.
Right, I had that too.
Okay, well, that's the only drug that I ever had to have, that I ever threw up with.
Okay.
And so after that happened, I had to move back to West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
So that brings me to where I am now. I had tried to volunteer at some places, and I tried to work as a patient navigator. And I was trying to just, at the time I wasn't coming in as a navigator, what I was trying to do was to come in and just be a part of our local cancer center.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't really know where to put me and that kind of thing. So I ended up getting a job that I just paid something so I could be working.
Right.
Well, it ended up that before I had gotten that job, I had gotten laid off, and I ended up in limbo for about 2 months. And I was really discouraged because it was the first time I'd ever had to file for unemployment.
But that's okay. I mean, you can pay. That's part of what you pay the government for.
Yeah, I know, but I'm a very prideful person, and so it's really hard because I've never accepted that. And so that time frame, though, is when God really slapped me in the face, and he said, hold on. In January, I had submitted an application to the Patient Navigation Institute in Harlem, and I was waiting, and I submitted my story, and I said, this is why I want to be a navigator. I've heard about your program. I know you've been doing things since 1990. I know I want to be a part of this. Can somebody train me? Because all I was looking for somebody to do was to let me have an internship either in psychosocial oncology where I could, you know, do what I needed to do and have a job that I enjoyed doing.
Right.
And nobody was offering that in any of the psychosocial programs that were around. I had called every hospital across the country saying, here's who I am. Here's what I have to offer. Does anybody have any help? And they didn't have the funding. Nobody had the funding, or they didn't know what it was really about and didn't know how it worked. The other thing that kind of got me kind of pigeonholed, too, was they were looking at the medical model of patient navigation and assigning social workers and nurses to those particular realms, thinking that it needed to be a clinical position when it didn't. The benefit of having somebody like me is I've been through that. So
right.
If you're going to deal with patients like me and you, would you rather have somebody that has degrees or been through your experience?
Well, I agree. I'd rather have somebody who's been through it, for sure.
And so that's kind of where I ended up getting pigeonholed. Well, Dr. Freeman, Harold Freeman, who pioneered the program, accepted my application. I got a grant, about $3,000, and they managed through a group of folks that I was working with here in West Virginia, had asked me to be part of a survivorship committee, and they also asked me to be part of patient navigation services, found the money to fly me there. I had none of this, by the way. So I was just praying. I was just hoping. I was like, something's got to break here. I've done this for way too long. I'm just, somebody give me a chance. And so he did. And they flew me up there, and I got my training, and I came back, and I had had some offers, but people were still like, well, you know, ACS has a program, so they're going to do that. And the reason that they chose to use the ACS people was because they split the salaries with these organizations so that ACS can have their navigator in there and that kind of thing. But the thing that really impressed me about where I was trained, Mel, was the patient navigation program that Dr. Freeman had designed. And he originally had worked at American Cancer Society as the president for a while, okay?
Yes.
It's a program that increased continuum process. So, for example, if you were to come in and you were to be part of his program, the first thing that they have is they have an outreach navigator. And that person goes in and tries to help promote free screenings and that kind of stuff, breast, colon, whatever. And then what they do is they would say, Mel, well, listen, we have these free screenings at your age. Would you be interested in a free screening, that kind of thing? And you would say yes or no or whatever. And so if you say yes, then what I would do on the spot is I would set the appointment through my palm back to the office. They would call you, set up your appointment, and bring you into the clinic. Then what they would do is they would have a diagnostic navigator read the test. When they get that established and they say, Mel, you don't have it, or Mel, you do have it.
Wait, is that a doctor?
Yes, doctor, nurse, who, surgeon, whoever looks at it
and
does your testing, your screening, whoever reads your screening, okay? And then what they would say is, okay, Mel, it turns out that you do have this. So what we're going to do is we're going to put a financial navigator to walk you through this whole thing. Well, that's one of the blessings that you could have, because then you have somebody that can go and get the finances you might not be able to have for drugs and whatnot. And so that was just really kind of cool that they had thought it out to this far.
Yes, that's nice.
And I'm like, yo, this rocks. This is what I would have done. Somebody beat me to it, but this is exactly the way I would have done it. And I was really excited. And then what they found out was the next navigator was the oncology navigator. And what that person does is explains everything to folks and helps them understand what barriers are there so that they can remove those barriers. If you can't get to treatment because you can't travel, we find a way to get you there.
Right.
If you have insurance issues, we find ways to get everything accomplished. So you're not doing it by yourself is basically the premise. But you're not being left alone either.
So
there's no way for you to drop in the cracks of that system because there's somebody with you continually. Now, the next step that they're really looking at doing is adding a survivorship navigator.
So now, where do they have these Navigator at? Different hospitals, or are they?
Yeah, the Navigators now are showing up all across the country.
Oh, okay.
And the reason that Navigators are showing up all across the country is because the College of American Surgeons has recognized that these need to be in all of the major cancer centers so that they can provide psychosocial help, survivorship education, and navigation services for these patients.
Okay.
And so they've set these new standards up coming out in 2011 that these are the things that major cancer centers need to have in place, you know, if they were going to be looking at NIH and that kind of thing for help for funding and whatever. Well, now a lot of the pharmaceutical companies are jumping on, and my local pharmaceutical rep from district manager from Pittsburgh has been major plugging in to what we're doing here in West Virginia. And his name is Jim Demsky. And Jim works for Pfizer Oncology. Well, Pfizer Oncology is a major player with this, and Amgen had helped Dr. Freeman with his and given him his first medical grant so that he could get the funding to upstart the program that they have at Ralph Lauren Cancer Center is where he's located. And so the next step that they were going to add was a survivorship navigator, okay? Now, here's the question. If I were a survivorship navigator and we were finished with the process and they said, okay, Mel, you're about done. You've done great with your service, that kind of thing. If you have issues, you know, we're going to track you, say, for the next 6 months, we'll track you once a month. And if we see anything after that, then everything's good, then we'll let you go and we'll keep in touch with you. Okay?
Okay.
That's one way to do it. Now, if I were to say to you, Mel, while you were being treated, I'm Brett and I'm your survivorship navigator. And you would say, well, you're just another person. Why would you need me? You know, why do I need you? Mm-hmm. What's your purpose? And I might say to you, hey, Mel, here's the thing. We know that your breast cancer might be able to come back. It might relapse. You might relapse at some point. If we stand with the standard model and let it be a month, 2 months, 3 months, whatever, then if it does relapse, we have less time to keep you mentally in the game and be able to have you have a resource that you can call upon if you need it.
Okay.
So what we're going to do is we're going to do more testing sooner so that we can track it the whole time, and we may do more of them for a short period of time or for a longer period of time. But eventually what we're doing is we're tracking for the longevity of it, and we're also going to be looking at the side effects
right.
that might be coming as a result of this.
Right.
If you do it the other way, you wouldn't know what side effects you would be having. So maybe a month later, you're feeling all this crap, and you don't know, and you go back, and you don't know what it is. And
well,
you go back
I kind of disagree with that because I know a lot of hospitals do talk about side effects, you know. I mean, I don't think it's every hospital that does that, but...
No, and I'm not saying that every one of them does, but it's good to know what the side effects would be to be able to track them is what I'm getting at.
Of course.
I'm not saying that they aren't doing them, but doing it that one way versus another way, okay?
Okay.
Then that way it keeps you informed the whole process. So then you have all of these people that you can go back to that have worked with you, where if you have questions, if you have concerns, if you're off for a while and you need to call somebody, you have a group of folks that you can continually go back to as things arise. Mm-hmm. Hey, you know, I'm feeling this. Is this normal? Hey, I'm feeling that. Is that something I should be concerned about? This happened. And it's not where you're out there by yourself.
Right.
In other words.
I think that's one of the good things is that, you know, your group and a lot of other hospitals, and especially like social media, has been getting on this as well as the whole survivorship issue.
Well, very much so, and it's really something that people are starting to pay attention to because you're having more survivors that are coming out. The problem is the same drugs are being used, and people just need to be educated on what to look for.
Exactly,
especially when it comes to hearts and all the other stuff.
Oh, yes. So now you're a master level counselor. Yeah, there's my chemo brain coming. So if people want to get a hold of you and find out more about your program and find out where the hospitals are that have navigators, how would they get a hold of you?
Well, the organization that I have is called WalkingMiracles.org.
Okay.
And it is in the process of being developed. I am not, quote-unquote, practicing patient navigator. I'm still trying to find a place that would want a patient navigator.
Okay.
But I do have the resources where I have connections with a lot of the different hospitals across the country because I've personally called them and I can be a resource to people. WalkingMiracles.org is my website. My email address is wilsoncancerconsulting@gmail.com. People can reach me either one of those two ways. And I'm really excited coming up this month because next week we are having our second West Virginia Patient Navigation Conference.
Nice.
Our first one, we had five people that were interested. We had 40 folks from around the state of West Virginia that were interested, and they showed up to the conference. And it was really exciting to see the vibe and the excitement for patient navigation. Well, since that conference, there have been several different ACS navigators that have been implemented here in the state of West Virginia. Virginia and also in Ohio. And so people are now starting to come up with, oh, what's the concept and how are things going? Well, I got really excited about it because I was one of the people that helped start the conference.
Right.
And we found out this year, coming up next Tuesday on the 15th, that, no, Tuesday's the 16th, isn't it? Yes, 16th.
Okay.
Chemo brain, I can't claim that.
Exactly.
Anyway, the 16th is on a Tuesday. We have 85 people coming.
Oh, excellent.
Which is really exciting, and they have a waiting list right now, and the max that we can hold is 100 people. Well, it just so happens that Dr. Harold Freeman is going to be our featured speaker that morning. We have folks from West Virginia, Ohio, Pennsylvania coming in, and we also managed to talk to the people at the Lance Armstrong Foundation.
Excellent.
And they're going to be coming in talking about cancer survivorship and patient navigation and how all that would work. So we're, just really excited about the opportunities and what's available, and hoping that, you know, maybe in a small place like us, we can kind of be light of hope to other folks who are trying to start programs or want some information and that kind of thing. So it's pretty cool.
Excellent, Brett. And you'll have to keep us posted on the Facebook page and on the website and let us know how that all transpires.
Yeah, and that would be awesome, and I'll see about getting you a link and that kind of thing so you can have that in case people want to contact through your show, or if I can work it out and do it with you, and then that way if they have direct connection with me or you and want to get a hold of you, then they can do that.
Excellent. Well, what an amazing story, Brett. You know, going from not having, what was it? They only gave you 6 months to live?
Yeah.
And how many years ago was that?
Well, let's see. I'm 38 now, and I just turned 38 in October, so that was 36 years and 6 months. So somebody's calendar planning was off.
Exactly. Whoops. Sorry about that, guys. Yeah, so anybody, any survivor out there who says, you know, so-and-so gave me X amount of time to live, they just need to listen to this podcast and listen to your story. Thank you so much for joining us today, Brett. I'm going to wrap it up like I usually do. This is The Cancer Warrior. You can always find me on Facebook because I am a Facebook junkie. Check out my Facebook fan page, The Cancer Warrior, on EmpowerRadio.com. I'm on Twitter, @MelMajoros. Check out my blog, thecancerwarrior.blogspot.com. And you know what? Life looks pretty good from where I'm sitting. Sending you good vibes. It's The Cancer Warrior on EmpowerRadio.com.